is Julia Horn testing. It is the 25th of May, and we're at St Paul's as part of the University Life History Series. what do I do? Okay.
All right. Well, delighted to have Julia. I don't think she needs much introduction, but just briefly, I think two things stand out. She's a distinguished member of this luncheon club, founding member, I think, probably, Alan, which now, I think, rivals the 1954 club at which it meets at St Andrews. One good thing, but she also has the distinguished title of university historian. In fact, I think it's the university historian. So
the only one.
When she speaks, it's ex cathedra, and I suggest that you listen. Finally, I thought the title of this was to be How We Came to Love the Yankee Dollar When It Was Freely Given, but it's not quite that. It is, in fact, a serious study of the Carnegie Corporation and the modern Australian history. So, talk, soup, then questions, yes. Right? Soup at 22. So there you are, Julia. Got till 22 for the paper. Look,
I should just, because we're recording it, the title's The Carnegie Corporation and the Modern Australian University.
Thank
you. Not history.
Sorry.
Now, there are various reasons why I became interested in the Carnegie Corporation in Australia in the interwar period, but they're too numerous to go through them. I tried, but I realised that was going to be the whole paper about how I became interested in the Carnegie Corporation. So I've tried to summarise it in this sheet, and what this sheet shows you to interpret it is that, of course, during the interwar period, the biggest amount of money that the Carnegie Corporation gave to Australia was to establish the Australian Council of Educational Research, which was its idea, and it established that in 1930 and then proceeded to fund it. And the Australian Council of Education Research is actually, it's a really big, important thing that they do throughout the world at that time. If you have the top 10 projects that the corporation funds around the world in this period, the ACER is about halfway down. So it's about fourth, fifth, sixth, there are a few around the same time. So it's very significant. But what I noticed was that if you take all Australian universities together and the Carnegie Corporation funding of them, you start to realise that it's quite close to the funding of the ACER. So it's only proportionally, it's just a little bit less. And then here, this one down here, which is at 18%, includes museums, schools, and public libraries. So it was the fact that these two are funded at a sort of similar level, which interested me, and I wanted to know why that was the case and what they were on about. So that explains that table. Now, the Carnegie Corporation of New York, to give it its full title, became interested in Australia really in 1925, when it saw new opportunities to extend into the Pacific region. So it's at a time, of course, in the United States when it's isolationist, it's starting to get out of its isolationist phase, and the East Coast is recognising that there's another ocean in the world, not just the Atlantic, but also the Pacific Ocean. And even though, of course, the United States had long had a lot to do with that ocean, you know, Hawaii, the Philippines, and of course Japan, the East Coast was starting to recognise that if it was to have any sort of clout in world politics, it really had to work out its role in the Pacific Ocean. And looking there, of course, there was New Zealand and Australia, both democratic nations which spoke English, and it's really that sort of connection which brought Carnegie Corporation attention onto Australia. So that's why they became interested in Australia. More particularly in universities, this was, you know, partly because universities here were public and they were state-funded, and that was a very recognisable institutional form to Americans, which has, you know, which had and has a strong public state-based university system, I suppose. And they recognised that that could well be a very useful point of contact with America. And would help it facilitate US engagement with this region, especially through educational and cultural relations. Now, the corporation interests in interwar Australia, especially in its universities, which, because of the forum, that's what I'll be concentrating on today, of course provides, I think, an alternate view to understanding American-Australian relations in this period. So that we know that historians of Australian foreign relations, Neville Maney, Norman Harper, Carl Bridge and so forth, have established that diplomatic channels between the two countries in this period, in the interwar period, were almost non-existent, partly because of Australia's strong attitude that it belonged to the British Empire, and this was all compounded by fraught trade relations at that time between America and Australia, also between Japan and Australia, of course, because of Australia's closed empire market approach. But by focusing instead on cultural, intellectual and educational relations, of course, a different picture begins to emerge, one in which the American tradition of philanthropy played an earlier and, I think, relatively positive role in American and Australian interwar relations. Now, I should just pay reference here to Noel McLaughlin because of his groundbreaking essay, Future America, explained that the role of America as an idea, not the nation, so America, the idea, he explored that in the thinking of British colonials in the 19th century, which has been a theme taken up by other historians, of course, including Richard Waterhouse at this university in his work on the history of Australian popular culture. So that in my bigger project looking at Carnegie and, I hope, eventually Rockefeller, that's at the back of my mind, you know, just to think that with this engagement with Australian universities, that the role of America must have actually been at the back of the minds of many vice-chancellors as well as professors, that it's there, and it's there at a period that we traditionally see as very British-oriented. I'm not saying it's not British-oriented, but, you know, what role did it play in this period that we conventionally see as being quite anti-American? Okay. In 1928, and then the period that straddles the end of 31 and the beginning of 32, the Carnegie Corporation funded two trips of specially selected men to report confidentially on the situation and character of education in Australia. A prime aim of the visits was to make contact with key players in higher education. Now, the corporation had long been interested in universities around the world. They'd funded many university schemes in the United States, in Great Britain and Canada. And so there was nothing particularly unusual in having their men report on Australian universities and recommend the funding of potential projects. And so the aim of this paper is to examine the assessments of the first two visitors. There were a number over the course of this period up to the late 30s, in order to understand why the corporation decided to give money to Australian universities at this time between the wars. Now, of course, Carnegie interests in Australia can be interpreted in a number of different ways, familiar in contemporary historiography, so, you know, the way we write history. First, there's the hegemonic influence of philanthropic foundations as a form of American cultural imperialism, so why we come to love the Yankee dollar, whatever you're calling this, as a form of American cultural imperialism, which in the context of Australia has been explored in the work of W.F. Connell and Michael White, who looked at what the Australian Council of Educational Research in Australia, what that meant. And their argument is that you can see it as a form of cultural imperialism. It did a lot of good things, but it certainly was something which the Americans put here and the Australians had to respond to, at least in this period. Now, secondly, the second sort of historiographic strand is, I think it can be seen as an aspect of an emergent Australian nationalism that began to look to the United States and the world more generally, not just to Britain and its empire. So these are both really important factors associated with the arrival of Carnegie at this time. But my focus is, today at least, is much more on the history of higher education and takes that up as a strand, and that is the complex tensions around the very idea of a university at this stage, as well as the emerging notion of a modern university, and in particular, what the new type of academic would look like in this new place. Now, in these terms, the Carnegie visitors arrived to find a university system they believed was unsuited to a newly internationalised world, one which had yet to articulate itself as a national system of research, as well as teaching, let alone one within an international academic community. Now, of course, they were a bit unfair in that last part because the British Empire provided, in fact, a fabulous international community of scholars, and one which, as the work of Tamsin Peach has shown, was really used by Australians extremely effectively. But they were Americans, and you know that was Britain, so that didn't really count. To Americanise, Australian universities appeared to be cemented in the ancient tradition of gentlemen scholars. They absolutely panned that idea, whose international network was firmly within the British Empire, in contrast to the modern notion of the researcher with expertise in a specialised field of study, as had recently emerged in American universities. What they noticed was that there was little that could be called a career structure within our universities. Academics weren't promoted on the basis of merit. Instead, it seemed to them, they travelled the course of the British Empire, usually to English or Scottish universities and often back to Australia, in order to move from one position to another, which did little to contribute to nation building here, or in fact to what they saw as the prime importance of public universities, the democratisation of knowledge. So with no culture of the expert, nor a career structure, Australian universities also lacked efficient governance and administrative structures, relying instead on outdated systems of patronage, entirely unsuited to a democratic society. And I should just add here, that throughout their reports, they're all the time commenting on, on Australia being the coming democratic nation, that there was a lot that Americans could learn about democracy here. So they're very conscious that democracy is alive and flourishing in Australia. And they're also, as we'll see, you know, they can see the sort of what they call democratic engagements that universities here had with their community, but they just could not work out the system of having an honorary vice-chancellor or chancellor as leading and, you know, running the place, or they saw it as running the place, rather than having an academically trained professional, you know, an academic who had risen up and was then paid full-time to develop the institution to its greatest capacities. Now, while forces for change ultimately came from within the system, and it's really important to emphasise that, nonetheless, the Carnegie Corporation in the interwar period looked to fund projects they believed would help this process of modernisation. Of course, such actions have overtones of cultural imperialism, but in hindsight, I think, we can see this, it's just far more accurate to see it, I think, as a fundamental moment in the global transformation of higher education, in which Australia was seen by these outsiders to be lagging behind the rest of the world. Now, in the late 1920s, when the corporation began to notice Australia, we have to remember that universities were on the cusp of financial ruin. The situation had been different at the beginning of the 20th century, when optimism, matched by private and public funding, had surged through most universities, which put into action ambitious plans for new buildings, scientific laboratories, as well as a really greatly expanded academic workforce to tackle the challenges of a new century. The first decade of the 20th century had also seen the rapid expansion of Australia's universities, including plans and the eventual establishment of two new universities, the University of Queensland and then in 1911, the University of Western Australia, which brought the total number of universities here to six, one in each state. They were all public universities funded by the state, but still with a focus on what you might call the civic purpose of serving communities, largely state-based communities, rather than addressing issues of the new nation state. With the exception of the University of Tasmania, all these universities enjoyed successful relationships with generous benefactors. In fact, endowment income was a really important component of most university budgets, and without this income stream, universities would have been unable to undertake many of their grander schemes. But in 1928, on the brink of a worldwide economic recession and still suffering the consequences of a considerable war debt, state governments had already begun the process of withdrawing themselves from funding universities beyond the considerable commitment that many of them had to providing free education. So Queensland and WA both provided free education, and in, say, Sydney, the government was providing significant numbers of teachers' college scholarships, state bursaries and public exhibitions, which effectively meant that a significant number of students did not pay fees and actually got a stipend too. So we can't forget that commitment. But in terms of the, are they called recurrent budgets? In terms of that endowment that was supposed to be coming, state governments were largely beginning to withdraw almost completely. I mean, they couldn't withdraw completely because the state government was governed by statute to provide grants. But, you know, this is how the Vice-Chancellor starts seeing it. And, of course, with more students and staff than ever before, universities were beginning to clamber to reorganise finances and structures that would keep the operations afloat. Yet despite this threat of ruin, the Carnegie visitors observed, then looked beyond what the obvious signs of decrepitude, really, and informed their masters that all was not lost. Carnegie Corporation's support for universities could be justified not simply on the basis of broadening US influence in a democratic nation, but to help universities put into action plans for adapting to modern times. So the first of these Carnegie men to come out and report specifically for the corporation on Australian universities was James Russell, the former Dean of the Teachers College at Columbia University, which itself was a powerhouse institute of educational research. And he visited Australia in 1928. And the choice of Russell for the first reconnaissance trip, I think, was really crucial to early Carnegie relations with universities here. He understood the importance of universities as sites of vibrant research cultures, as well as their significance to national development. That's how, that was, you know, what he saw the role of public universities in, say, the United States. Russell had studied in Leipzig for his PhD in philosophy and psychology, where he learnt the social science tradition of collecting and analysing data, and which he saw as crucial for the advancement of education. He developed postgraduate programs at Columbia to train future educationists from around the world in the art of research, to equip them to become experts on education policy back in their own countries. And that included Australians, for example, Ken Cunningham, who became Professor of Education at Melbourne and later the CEO of the Australian Council of Educational Research, a nice sort of network link there between from his time in America, as well as Percival Cole, who was at Sydney Teachers College here in the grounds of the university. Now, Russell visited five of Australia's six universities, all except for Queensland. Recognising that each was a public university, he looked for democratic engagements with broader publics, and he generally liked what he found. He liked Adelaide University's system of workers' education programs. I think almost every university at this time actually has an adult education program, which Carnegie actually funds all of them. But he particularly liked Adelaide's one. He also judged the University of Western Australia to be, and he described it as, the most virile and progressive of any that I have seen, and he meant anywhere, not just here. And that was because of its programs of engagement, which included, and I think it's even earlier than the United States, it included radio programs that came out of universities. So, you know, that engagement with the wider community in many different and different ways of doing that. And he saw that as the democratic spirit essential to the well-being of public education. In Melbourne, he wrote that the university is more efficient and has a better staff than Sydney and is in closer touch with public, but nothing to boast of. Yet what troubled him about Melbourne, apart from not getting a really welcome, apparently a really warm welcome, troubled him about Melbourne was that he found an iniquitous system in operation that disadvantaged the publicly funded university in favour of the university's affiliated and very wealthy residential colleges, and that students lucky enough to be in those colleges were provided with exceptionally fine privileges, he wrote, whereas students who went, you know, the rest of the students weren't. So that troubled him. At Sydney, he found departments staffed with what he described as the type of professor, much like Columbia in the 80s, he meant 1880s, of course, each a scholar of breadth in his own field, rather than, he implied, experts in specialised areas of research. In Hobart, poor Hobart, Russell found a state only recently saved from bankruptcy by the federal government and a university with most of its professors, he said, old or worn out. Now, throughout his trip, he worried about Australian attitudes towards the United States. By the end of the trip, he wrote, "I'm slowly coming to the conviction that hostility to America is confined to two groups, the university pundits, whose world centres on Oxford and Cambridge, and the industrial classes who feel the effects of American competition in manufacturing. The great middle class, public school people generally, and especially everyone who has been at any time in the States, all are enthusiastic and lauding all things American all the time. Indeed, they are blind to our faults. I'm certain that one of the best things that could be done would be to provide travelling expenses for a few leaders in the educational field to visit the USA and Canada every year." Now, he believed in the opportunities offered by travel, especially for elders, those at the top of their fields who could see how things were done elsewhere and then return to effect change. And it soon came to be implemented, this idea of providing travel grants or travel awards to elders was soon implemented by the corporation. These travel awards were also used by the corporation, actually, we can't forget, to support American academics to Australia who also come in this period. Now, the policy of funding elders to the US, I think, introduced a new element to the career path of an Australian academic. At this stage, funded academic travel was mostly the preserve of recent graduates who were sent, usually to Britain or elsewhere in the empire, to establish themselves as scholars. This new scheme, as well as the Rockefeller Travel Grant Scheme that began about the same time, enabled established academics to fund extended trips to universities outside Australia during the course of their career, not only at its beginning. And so it helped in that way, I think, to promote the transformation of academics from scholars, with the American idea that a scholar sits in his study with his library around him and, of course, students at his feet. I'm not saying that's what it was, but, you know, that's the idea, to researchers, to that notion that, you know, researchers also taught, that was an important part, so there are still students there, but they needed to get out and either to go to a laboratory or to go into the field anyway, but just leave their place of employment into the bigger world to discover things and come back and put that into, you know, general public discourse through teaching and other sorts of engagements. And so, but of course, the other primary aspect of the scheme is that and the intention by the corporation was that it opened up the possibilities of new academic networks outside the empire. So the idea that now people here would know who was in the US and that that might even start opening up employment opportunities in either countries. Now, James Russell also observed the operations of universities themselves, making copious notes about enrolment figures, funding arrangements, academic salary scales. I mean, it's an enormous report. Building and other infrastructure and the major disciplines with research potential. He noted the difficulties in establishing a research culture in overworked university departments. Though, I mean, many of these, you know, like this one, hadn't actually made new appointments since that great flush in the 1890s and early 1900s. So, there were many more students, so they were in some ways struggling. Though agricultural research was supported, he noted, research into education, for example, rarely was. And he wrote, the few persons in the universities and teachers' colleges capable of doing scientific research are burdened with routine duties and have little time or strength for special studies. So he compiled these facts, figures, and personal observations into a report, in some ways a sort of oracle, because the corporation keeps coming back to this report and it's sent out to lots of people to inspire new ideas and, you know, to think, what else can we do? Well, in 1932, Dr. Lotus D. Kaufman arrived in Sydney, and he was consultant to the corporation and was to consolidate the corporation's forays into Australian universities. Kaufman was the president of the University of Minnesota and he'd been that since 1920. Like James Russell, he also was a university man, a trained researcher who'd graduated with his PhD from Columbia's Teachers College, Russell's institution, and who represented the new generation of highly qualified professionals in charge of universities. He was an experienced commentator on educational affairs and sought after by many state governments in the United States to survey their educational systems, and was even invited by the Soviet government in 1928 to study educational methods there. He was a staunch supporter of public education, a progressive in that sense, and shortly before his engagement by the Carnegie Corporation to visit and report on Australia, he created a stir by arguing, by criticising, got a lot of media coverage, by criticising wealthy philanthropists for giving money to the private universities and, you know, giving their wealth rather to the private universities and only giving dribs and drabs to the public state universities. In Kaufman's view, the health of public universities was a measure of the nation's health. They were vital nation-building institutions that trained experts and supported research as a contribution to broader policy development as well as public debates. Now, he came here to report specifically on Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide, and this time also Brisbane. I think they finally realised that Brisbane was part of the Pacific. Having learnt from Russell that Australian universities were great defenders of England and the British Empire, he observed that they were responding, he wrote, reluctantly to be sure, to the pressure and sanctions of their own environments and to the needs of a new day. Now, the provincial and traditional character of the institutions was one weakness in the Australian university tradition. The other, according to Kaufman, was the lack of a proper academic career structure, where advancement was awarded on merit, which it wasn't here, he said, not on the depth of a hapless professor, which is what he thought happened here. He put it thus, many lecturers of talent are caught in a trap. They live on meagre salaries with little promise of advancement and with little institutional pressure for achievement. Vice Chancellor Wallace hopes to change this at Sydney. Okay. Now, Kaufman's aim was to provide a rationale for the support of universities. And so he looked for signs of change as a measure of whether corporation assistance might be welcomed. He looked for and often found signs of modernisation, including within the mostly creaky administrative structures of universities, and made special notes of research capabilities in institutions otherwise lacking a distinctive research culture. He praised Sydney University for its newly adopted modern administrative model, in which the Vice-Chancellor now held a full-time position and was appointed from a field of prospective candidates, all of whom were proven and respected academics. And that replaced the past practice of appointing a person who was normally a leading citizen, often a lawyer, I think, to serve the university in an honorary capacity. Melbourne University was about to do the same, and Kaufman decided that until it did, when a strong hand could set well-defined policy necessary for a modern institution, it would remain in second place to Sydney. And when it finally did, it appointed Priestley. Suddenly, money was flowing from the corporation for research, for changing administrative structures, all these sorts of things. So they're certainly looking at, having an institution that they can recognise as being something that can take the university forward. While physical infrastructure was often condemned, he'd never seen such poor physical conditions for students as those at Queensland University. And Melbourne buildings were, he wrote, nearly worn out and most poorly kept. He expressed enthusiasm for scholastic standards and keenly observed emerging signs of a national research culture. At Sydney University, Robert Wallace presented Russell with a list that he titled Desirable Needs of the University, which Kaufman diligently commented upon confidentially for the benefit of the Carnegie Corporation. Some desirable needs, like the request to fund like the request to fund a Carillionist, were roundly rejected, though Wallace may have, I think, included this item, aware of fellow Scotsman Andrew Carnegie's desire in an earlier era to install church organs all over Britain, and some of them actually came to Australia. But Kaufman perked up with interest at requests for research funding or projects that encouraged academics to contribute to national policy. And at Sydney, he supported the idea to fund a research journal in geography, the first of its kind in Australia. He did the same in Melbourne and in Adelaide. There was a lot to praise there because of the Waite Institute of Agriculture, which he saw as, that this was exactly the sort of model, the model where research was being done, where professors knew what they were doing and they were taking on students and training them as researchers too. That was the model that he liked. And in Queensland, he also saw research work he liked, although it wasn't, none of the other places was it as formal as at Adelaide. So to conclude, what these Carnegie men found in Australia were universities that held fast to the notion that Britain and the Empire provide scholarly sustenance. They also questioned Australian intellectual conventions, especially the polite engagement with learned discourse in the liberal tradition, rather than the pursuit of highly specialised research that could contribute to the development of public policy, amongst other things. Both Russell and Kaufman believed these quaint traditions were entirely unsuited to the realities of the modern world, where Australia's position in the Pacific as a democracy should logically lead to greater engagement with the rising power of the United States, that would include academic discourse across the Pacific. And scholarship, of course, based on research, was a more relevant tool than that based on liberal discourse, they believed. They were appalled at the crumbling university infrastructure, especially an administrative system that, with only a few exceptions, still relied on leadership structures that had to grapple with a vastly different world from that of their predecessors. And they firmly believe that institutions required professional leaders to drive them forward. Yet all was not lost. Both Russell and Kaufman saw the beginnings of change in the universities they visited. They liked the people they met, mostly. They remarked upon the high educational standards, and they observed emerging research traditions in almost every university they visited. They came up with and supported the idea of travel grants that funded travel to the US for established scholars and educational leaders. And long after Russell and Kaufman had returned, they continued to take an interest in what was happening. They'd made friends here, I suppose, networks, and which were already open and continue for many years. And they also look after Australian academics who come, who visit there on Rockefeller and Carnegie fellowship travel grants. So the Carnegie Corporation certainly took notice of what these men had to say, and between 1928 and 1941, as that graph shows, they were the next biggest recipient of corporation grants to Australia after the Council for Educational Research. Almost $1 million, US dollars, was granted to Australian organisations in this period, which at a conservative estimate is over $28 million US dollars today. So it's not insignificant. It'd be nice if we could get that now, I suppose. And of this, the Council of Educational Research received about half, with universities and things like the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute and the Australian Institute of International Affairs, which are very close to universities, got just under 40%. The majority of that funding to universities was for the core activities of teaching and research, including the modernising the academic career structure. So there was money built in there so that academics could take leave, for example, and that a survey was done to assess the sort of administrative structures that were not good. In terms of travel, between 1934 and 37, six Americans were fully funded to visit Australia for research. So that's Americans coming here. And four of them were directly related to universities. In the same period, 10 Australians were fully funded to go to the US on these programs, five from Australian universities. And that's a very conservative figure because, in fact, a lot more were going. I mean, some were going through Rockefeller, but also the Carnegie Corporation was giving grants to universities to dispense, to send people over to America, to the United States. So it's just what we... who we know about in this formal scheme, not all the others. Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney and WA were earmarked for research projects nominated by each institution, as well as contributions to fund academic leave. Funding was also provided for lectureships. This scheme, called the Displaced German Scholars Scheme, funded refugee academics who escaped Germany in the 1930s. All of whom brought, of course, new research traditions to Australia, very strong ones, and offered also new scholarly networks extending both within and outside the British Empire. And it's a really interesting scheme. So the aim was to help Australian universities create a new university tradition where academics had a proper career structure and where genuine support was given to create a research culture and to offer opportunities to travel to the US, not just to Britain. You know, the foundations, of course, were seeking to influence the evolution of Australian universities here, attempting them to drag them away from the British tradition of gentlemanly scholarship and so forth. And there was also undoubtedly inertia in Australian higher education. I mean, there just wasn't much money around apart from anything else. And also inertia, I think, to adopt what many of them saw as foreign traditions. You know, academics don't like to change, and this was a new sort of challenge to them. But in the resource-constrained environment of Australian universities, the significant funds offered by the Carnegie and Rockefeller Foundations helped, I think, to speed a process of modernisation in Australian higher education. And that process, of course, we see accelerating in the war, with the Commonwealth government starting to come in, and, of course, the post-war, where, in the end, they take over that financial responsibility from the states. But also, most importantly, that they would support modern research universities in Australia as nation-building institutions. So that Australia's tradition of the public university as a civic institution, I think, finally crumbled. But the crumbling begins in this interwar period creating a new tradition of universities in the post-war period as a research and teaching institutions serving not only civic needs in the education of the professions, for example, but also national needs with the training of researchers and the creation of experts through students and so forth, graduates rather, whose work would inform public debate and discussion in all areas of national life. Thank you.
Thank you, Julia. I'm sure people didn't mind delaying their soup for just a few seconds. So.